Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Regular listeners to our podcast will recognize that I like to feature two different types of guests. First, being that we are an educational program, there are scholars of religion, sociologists, political scientists, historians, psychologists, and the occasional physicist who make it their profession to study religion from the human or sociological side of the equation. We feature well-known folks such as Rod Stark, Philip Jenkins, and Margaret Paloma, as well as lesser-known scholars who are on their way to making big contributions such as Carrie Casel, Alessandra Gonzalez, and Jared Rubin. The other type of guests I like to feature are what I tend to call, for lack of a better term, practitioners. Folks like clergy members, lawyers involved in religious issues, or folks running nonprofit charities. In this vein, we featured attorneys defending religious liberties, military chaplains, cowboy preachers, and officers for Opus Dei. This is not to say that these practitioners are not scholars in their own right. Indeed, they all have a keen understanding of their world, and their knowledge is extremely valuable, which is why I consider them to be an important part of this podcast project. Rather, these practitioners are folks that bring a different perspective and a set of eyes to our world's religious landscape. Today, I am very fortunate to have a person who straddles both of these worlds, someone who is trained as an academic scholar and a person who has been involved in transforming the religious marketplace through his actions in building churches, attending churches, and leaving churches. It is true that many of our academic guests are regular churchgoers and participate in spiritual organizations, but Professor William Clark, my guest today, gets more hands-on than many others that I know. Bill is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan, and what makes him all the more interesting as a guest is that his academic specialty is not religion per se, but rather he publishes most of his research in the realm of international and comparative political economy, writing about such subjects as financial interdependence, business cycles, African party systems, and social science methodology. Nonetheless, he is quite well read in the sociology of religion and has a couple projects doing in his research pot that relate specifically to religious institutions. Bill is the author and/or editor of three books, including The Political Economy of Monetary Institutions, Capitalism, Not Globalism, Capital Mobility, Central Bank Independence, and the Political Control of the Economy, and the widely used textbook, Principles of Comparative Politics. We will link to all of those books on our website for those of you who are interested. I should finally note that I consider Bill to be one of my favorite political scientists, and I recently had the pleasure of drinking lots of good beer with him in Ann Arbor, where we brainstormed the idea for this interview. Bill, hey, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hey, thanks, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, today, a little bit of a different interview. I normally prepare a list of questions I want to cover with my guest to help give some structure to the interview. Today, I only have a general, rough, sketchy outline beyond my introduction in this and the paragraph that I'm reading right now. So we're going to go free flow, a little bit like Indiana Jones walking across that invisible bridge, but nobody better to walk across that bridge with than Bill. So here's what I want to accomplish today. I want to take a survey of your life, particularly your involvement with faith-based institutions. And then along the way, I want you to step outside your skin and give us some sociological insights from what you've experienced. So are you ready to do that?
Sure, thanks.
All right. Hey, let's do what I do with a lot of my guests, is kind of look into their deep background and go back to when you were a kid. What's your religious background? Did you grow up attending church and stuff like that?
Sure thing. I was raised Catholic and went to a Catholic elementary school and was quite involved in the Catholic Church through my high school years.
Okay, so you did go to a Catholic high school?
No, I'm the only person in my family to not attend a Catholic high school, but I was involved in my Catholic church through my high school years.
Okay, so why didn't you go to a Catholic high school?
That's an interesting question. The argument I gave my father was I was interested in architecture and wanted to take some technical classes that were not available at the parochial school.
Yeah, because those Catholics, they don't know their architecture. You know, yeah. Didn't your dad say, "Hey, what about St. Peter's Basilica?" I mean, that was kind of a big deal.
So. Well, yeah, but we couldn't convince them to have mechanical drawing classes at Pope Paul VI. So
okay.
I'll tell you.
Okay, so you grew up Catholic, and I take it. In fact, I know that you're no longer Catholic.
That's a complicated question.
Okay.
I certainly was very involved in the Catholic Church. I was actually even, not many people know this, considering the priesthood.
Wow.
Through my high school years. Then I fell away from the faith, as many people do, in my early college years.
Let me ask you about that then, because, you know, as a high school kid, I vaguely remember my high school years. They were pretty hazy, right, back in the late 70s and early 80s and such. I would have never considered the priesthood. In fact, I very much didn't consider anything beyond a week in advance. So why were you thinking of the priesthood, say, in your sophomore, junior, or senior years?
I was heavily involved in my Catholic Church. I was involved in a program at a sort of evangelical outreach program in the Catholic Church called SEARCH, which was a sort of, lay-led weekend retreats for high school students. And I found that very rewarding, bringing the gospel to my fellow high school students, being involved in ministry, studying the Bible. I thought that I might have a gift for preaching. And as a Catholic, all roads seemed to point towards the priesthood if you wanted to be that involved in ministry.
Did anybody ever pull you aside at the Catholic Church and say, "Hey, Bill, you got a gift for this preaching. You should consider the priesthood"? I know because we talked with Margarita Mooney on a previous podcast, and at one point in time in her journey, she was tapped on the shoulder and said, "Hey, you know, you should consider the convent. You've really got some spiritual gifts here."
Yeah, I had a couple of friends that were young priests that were involved in the same programs that I was involved in, and they were enthusiastic and seemed to support my efforts at ministry.
Okay. So this is going on in high school, but then you say you kind of fall away from the faith. So you graduate from high school. Where are you off to next?
Well, I was off to college at a local commuter school where I was a jazz performance major.
Yeah.
And fancied myself kind of an intellectual bohemian type and didn't necessarily see a strong tension between that and my faith. But I think a key moment in my faith was my father's death when I was 19 years old. My father died of emphysema 6 months away from his retirement, and I had a hard time, as I think a lot of people do in those circumstances, seeing how this was the will of a just and merciful God. So I sort of shook my fist at the church and said, if the obituary of the masses isn't going to help me today, I can live the rest of my life without it, and sort of did the angry young man thing for a while.
Was this shortly into your college career, or were you near graduation?
I was, I think it was probably the spring of my freshman year.
Yeah, so pretty young.
Yeah.
Okay. So that kind of shook you from that, and you're this bohemian jazz guy.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I should mention, I didn't mention this in the introduction, but you are quite an accomplished musician on a lot of different instruments, and your wife has said very good things about your playing. I have yet to hear you.
Well, we'll have to do something about that.
I think we should. You don't have a guitar in your office right now, do you?
I usually do, but I don't today.
All right. So we'll have to hold that off for another time.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're in college. You're jazz musician. Are you still interested in architecture?
No, I had a falling out with architecture because I was a really terrible draftsman.
Yeah.
And so it was clear that wasn't where my gifts lay, and I started taking more and more music classes and kind of defining myself that way.
Okay, so let's then continue this journey. You're going through college. During your college years, you shook your fist at the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in your late freshman year. Is there any turns or any changes that occur while you're in your undergraduate tenure?
No, that's sort of where I stayed. Along the way, I got married. My wife was non-denominational Protestant who was, in her own ways, moving away from her church upbringing a little bit when we first met. And so I was kind of pursuing life self-consciously as a secular humanist.
Okay. And so you're going through college, and you... What makes you decide to go the academic route? I mean, jazz musicians, if you're really super famous, pays well, but otherwise not so much. How do you decide to go down the academic path?
Well, I dropped out of school because I had decided that life as a jazz musician wasn't for me, not for lack of pay, but because it was more business than it was music, and that wasn't attractive to me. I had the good fortune of studying with some of the world's best jazz musicians, and I looked at their life and thought, they spend a lot of time on the phone, and I'm not sure I want to do that. So I dropped out of school and got what we would call a day gig and worked in some businesses for a couple of years, and then decided to go back to school at nights, and I took classes to fulfill my general education electives, and loved every class that I took, and decided that, gee, if I could pay somebody to make me go to school the rest of my life, that would be a pretty good gig. And that's how I stumbled on the idea of becoming an academic.
And now the classes that you were taking, were they in political economy, economics? What were you doing at that time?
Everything. Philosophy, history, economics. Every class I took, I was like a kid in the candy store. There's nothing like a mind-numbing day gig to make school seem really attractive.
Yeah, and that definitely reflects your intellect too, because you pull from so many different areas. And if you're off in the workaday world, and then you come back to school, you're this big sponge just soaking up everything more, and probably appreciating it a lot more than your typical kid just out of high school, huh?
Absolutely, I'm a big believer that education is wasted on the young.
And so there you go. So you return from the workaday world. You're back in college. Spiritually, what's going on? Still same old secular humanism kind of stuff?
Same old, same old. My wife, when we had kids, my wife seemed interested in bringing them up in some church environment. And she eventually started bringing them to the church that she grew up in. And I would sit at home and read the New York Times on Sunday morning and do my secular humanist thing. I'd go occasionally, but I tend to get in fights with the pastors, and so I saw that wasn't really helping my kids very much.
What did you get in fights about? Was there certain theological issues, philosophical issues,
yeah,
or just you didn't
generally,
like?
Generally, I had sort of grown up in a post-Vatican II Catholic environment with a kind of your buddy Jesus, peace, love, Catholic Church vibe that was going on in the mid-70s, and I was kind of comfortable with that, and I found the sort of more stricter versions of Protestantism a bit austere for my taste.
Okay, so this... And you said this was your wife's former church, and you said that it was a non-denominational church, and this was in the 1980s-ish, right?
Yes.
So that's pretty early for non-denominationalism to be kicking in. I mean, obviously they're around because she was going to one of them, but was this some kind of new church that was coming? Describe a little bit of this, what this
no,
was.
No, it was, I think, probably an old-school, independent, for lack of a better word, Baptist church, but not really tied into the denominational association, but there's a pretty strong notion of a sort of independent fundamentalist congregation, essentially, is what it was.
Okay, so you're going, let's say you finish up with undergraduate college, now you're on and off into this church, avoiding fights over the strictness of the theology, I guess, in terms of the church. You go to graduate school next?
I went to graduate school, and things stayed pretty much the same. My first job out of graduate school was at Georgia Tech in Atlanta,
okay,
where my wife attended Roswell Second Baptist Church, and things were pretty much the same. I would go every once in a while, and the kindly Southern woman would say, it's so good to see you, and I knew that meant, where have you been?
yeah, exactly, yes. Yeah, it always started, God bless your soul, and then they ride right into the gossip and all that kind of stuff. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's coming down the
pipeline.
But
the church was very supportive to my wife at the time, and my kids did well there, and I was kind of grateful for that. I guess we had a kind of don't ask, don't tell policy in the household.
You know, I'm going to take a step back. You're at Rutgers for graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're pretty much a Northeast type of guy. You grew mm-hmm. up in New Jersey, correct?
Yes.
And, you know, so Rutgers right there. You spent some time in New York, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're down in the South.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about what you're observing. And now, again, this is a step out of your skin a moment and sociological analysis of you're moving to the quote unquote Bible Belt from
right.
your Northeast corridor upbringing. What are you seeing there in terms of religion and how is this shaping you, do you think?
Well, it certainly was a much less Catholic, more Protestant cultural perspective. You know, it's hard to distinguish the religious influences versus the Southern cultural influences. There was a much more emphasis on gentility and politeness than I was used to in New York, but it didn't take me long to figure out that there was a subtext to a lot of the language that was being used there. As a political economist, I'm not particularly sensitive to culture, but I think moving into the South taught me, in some ways, the importance of culture.
Mm-hmm. And so your wife, you said, was going to a Baptist church?
Yes, Roswell Street Second Baptist, I think it was called.
Okay, and that's in Atlanta, right? Because Georgia Tech's in Atlanta.
It's a small town just on the northern suburbs of Atlanta.
Okay. Yeah. And did you start going a little bit more to church at this time, or?
No, pretty much the
same
thing.
Old.
A couple
okay.
times a year. Complete with, you know, debriefing the kids on the way home about where I did. See, one of the big problems with me for church by that point as an academic was I was in a culture where if you sat and listened to somebody for 20 or 40 minutes, you got to tell them that they were wrong at the end of it.
Yeah.
And it was real hard for me to bite my tongue through some of these sermons.
That's a really interesting observation because we're so used to being in front of a classroom for mm-hmm. 50 minutes, an hour and a half, or giving presentations. That's oftentimes difficult for us on a regular basis to sit in the audience and absorb a sermon. And I've thought of this numerous times in our church that sometimes I'm sitting there and I want to take notes and then raise my hand saying, but what about this? And I go, no, you can't do that now. Save it for afterwards with the pastor. But there's other times I have found it to be very liberating that it's just I don't have to engage in big, huge arguments and debates. I can just kind of sit back and let it happen. I don't know. Maybe I don't know if you have that feeling or have had that feeling.
I have had that feeling.
Yeah.
But it didn't. I think it came a lot more easily after experiencing grace.
Okay. Well, let's get to that experiencing grace. So you're in the northern suburbs of Atlanta, and you're at Georgia Tech for about 4 years, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And so you get recruited to NYU.
No, in between, a very crucial step is I got a postdoc at Princeton.
Ah, back to New Jersey.
And back to New Jersey, but a different New Jersey than the one I grew up in
mm-hmm.
from a socioeconomic standpoint. And we're back in Princeton, and that's really where the rapid return to a spiritual life occurred.
Aha, it's the Presbyterians.
Yeah. No, it was not the Presbyterians. It was actually just outside Princeton at a non-denominational church, but now a sort of user-friendly Willow Creek Association type non-denominational church that my wife stumbled into. She was when we moved back to Princeton, she was taking the kids 45, 50 miles north to the church she grew up in on Sunday mornings. And one week the pastor at her home church said, you know, we love to see you guys, but my friend Bob has a really nice church right next door. Maybe you guys should consider looking there instead of just schlepping up here every week.
Wow. Now talk about ecumenism.
Yeah, that's
right?
Really something. And she did, and it really transformed her life, and in through a complicated series of events, wound up transforming mine as well.
So before we get to that, I want to take this move up to Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And your wife is seeking out churches. Now, this is typical. We see this in sociological analyses of religion, that the woman is usually more religious than the man, and kind of brings the guy into here. So you move up to Princeton, and obviously she said, I'm going to drive an hour north to go to our previous church. But there was a definite settling in that she wanted to do in terms of a religious community, because oftentimes when people move around, they, you know, say, well, you know, first couple months we are not going to go to church. We just need to unpack the boxes. And, you know, then after a couple months, it's kind of hard to find something back there. But she was gung-ho about getting right back into the pews.
Well, I think living with me was all she needed to motivate her to find a spiritual community.
Okay. Got to save that guy at some point in time.
So, or just save herself.
Yeah, exactly.
Do it alone.
Okay. Because you were a beatnik jazz musician, I guess. So, okay. So tell us a little bit about this new church that she was recommended to go to. So just outside of Princeton, as I said, I kind of make a little joke about the Presbyterian Church, Princeton being a Presbyterian university and still the Princeton Theological Seminary there. And I have to admit, I was very curious when I was out there recently. I went to a Presbyterian church, literally just a block off the campus, just to get the Presbyterian thing. And it was a pretty liturgical, tough go to keep myself awake kind of church.
Yeah.
And so tell us about what else is there in that Princeton, New Jersey territory.
This was, I said before it was non-denominational. That's not technically true. It was a Christian Missionary Alliance church. But it was run by a fairly entrepreneurial, evangelical pastor who really had a heart for bringing Christ to the surrounding area. It wasn't in Princeton per se, it was in the suburbs around it, and so in that way it was, if you drove down the street, you'd think you were in the western Chicago suburbs. So they had been in touch with Willow Creek and bought that sort of model of the attractional church, and they were doing it very well.
Was this a mega church? Did it draw in a couple thousand, or
well,
was it a couple hundred?
At the time my wife first started attending, it was about 750 people, and they were meeting in a space they rented from to turn the tables a little bit, from a Boy Scouts council in the area. So they used their place on Sundays. And my wife started attending there, and a year later they built a church nearby and doubled their attendance in one weekend.
In one weekend?
Yeah.
Just through a new building?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. I tell people that the physical space can matter quite a bit.
Yeah.
And people say, no, spirit will overcome it. And I said, carpeting and all that kind of stuff matters too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us about your transformation here. I mean, is your
well,
wife saying?
Yeah, so the key moment, I think, well, there were two things that happened at Princeton, maybe three, that were interesting. One is I met a sociologist, a sociology graduate student, who lent me a copy of Rodney Stark's Rise of Christianity, which I read with great interest. And I think Stark treating Christians seriously and as rational beings played an important role in the softening of some of the intellectual barriers I had to face.
Yeah, can you give a shout out to that graduate student, or do you want to keep that anonymous?
His name is Brad Wilcox.
I know him.
I knew you would.
He has been on this show.
Yes.
Okay.
And he's a terrific scholar. At the time, he was. He also, I used to visit him and go to the local Opus Dei house for barbecue.
The local Opus Dei house for barbecue.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was interesting.
Is Brad
religious milieu in Princeton at the time?
Yeah. Is Brad Catholic? I didn't think he was.
Yes,
Catholic.
He is.
He is.
I don't know if it's okay for me to out him in that way.
Okay. Well, that you just told me went to an Opus Dei steakhouse, so
I was at the Opus Dei house too, but
it's interesting.
Exactly. Bring me up the code.
Yeah, it's interesting because he does a lot of his work on evangelical Protestants. So.
Yes.
Okay, very cool. So he lends you he
lends me Stark's book. I read it. It's not that the scales fell from my eyes, but it was nice to see Stark's rational choice perspective resonated with things that were going on in my life as a political economist. So it kind of made me feel at home a little bit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good, but really the key moment was my wife started attending this church, and one day I walked into our apartment in Princeton, and she's on the phone, and I said, "Who are you on the phone with?" And she said, "A woman from church. She wants us to. She's inviting us to come to a Bible study at her house." And I said, "Okay." And my wife almost dropped the phone. We started attending a small group Bible study that was connected with the aforementioned church, it was really a transformative experience.
I can imagine so, and I think this is going to play a big part of the story that when we get to Ann Arbor.
Absolutely.
So let's keep that in mind, the small Bible study group. You said it was transformative. How and why? And again, give us a personal flavor for this and also a little bit of a sociological view.
I mean, one reason why was it was a place where I could ask questions.
Okay.
Unlike a Sunday service, when, the group decided to read through the book of the Gospel of Matthew. And so we read through the nativity scene, and there are metaphysical associations being given to the movement of heavenly planets. And I say, there might be a natural explanation for this. So I would ask questions and was extremely skeptical. And my wife said that she felt every week she was going to get a call the next day saying, please Bill at home next week. But actually, people would call and say, Bill, I stayed up at 3 o'clock in the morning doing research, trying to answer Bill's questions, and it's really strengthening my own faith. So so it's great that he's in the group. Being the hard-headed Irishman that I am, I sort of held on to my skepticism for more than a year, I think, going to that group. Occasionally attending the Sunday services, but feeling much more at home in the group. And I don't think I was argued into the kingdom by having my questions answered in anything like a definitive or convincing way, but really what the group allowed was for a set of people to be Jesus in the skin for me.
Mm-hmm.
We were living in this town. We didn't really have any family close by. We were kind of deracinated, and they provided a sense of community in it, and a loving group of people who could show me what it was like to be a mature person living in this community, and that was, at the end of the day, very important for setting the context for my conversion.
Okay, so the postdoc at Princeton, was that a year or 2 years?
That was 1 year, but we settled so well into the neighborhood that we wound up living there for the first couple of years I was working at NYU. I left while at Princeton. I got offered a job at NYU, and because Lori and the kids were so happy living in Princeton and embedded in this community, I commuted back and forth to New York. So we stayed at that church for, I think, 4 years all told.
So I have to ask this on my academic curiosity. How does NYU find you and try to come and get you? I mean, I'm at Washington now, which is a great place, but it's pretty much that's where I'm going to end up for the rest of my life. So
yeah.
how does NYU get their claws on you?
Well, it's pure cronyism.
Okay.
I rekindled the relationship. I had met a professor at NYU, Professor George Downs, who, when I was a graduate student at Rutgers, he gave a talk at Rutgers, and when I got to Princeton as a visitor, we ran into each other in the mailroom on the first day there, and he said, "We're having lunch every Friday together." And we did, and over the course of the year, he was offered the chairmanship at NYU and was enthusiastic enough about my work to want to bring me with him.
I would think then this is another indication of how small groups are transformative.
Absolutely.
Because your Friday lunch gatherings were probably very similar in nature to the Bible study gatherings.
Well, it's true. In ways that I could go on and on about if I weren't reluctant to bring George's private life into this.
Okay. Well, very good. Let's get you up to NYU. So you're at the postdoc for 1 year, but you're still settling in Princeton, and you start commuting to NYU. What's happening in your life spiritually at this time?
Oh, well, the most important thing probably is that in addition to going to these small group meetings, the pastor at this church had taken a special interest to me and had agreed. I was teaching graduate classes on Wednesday night, and he would meet me at the Princeton Junction train station every week, and we'd have dinner together.
Oh.
And argue through things, which, again, I'm a very interactive guy.
Yep. I will verify that. and so this was before you went up to your graduate classes?
After.
So okay.
I'd get done teaching, and there wasn't a week that went by when I got off the train he wasn't standing next to his car.
Wow. So that is called pastoral outreach there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one-on-one right there. What time at night is this?
I'm sorry?
What time at night? I mean, just give me a little...
Probably 8 o'clock at night.
Okay.
Like that.
Yeah. And how long was the commute up to NYU?
2 hours door-to-door.
Wow. So 4 hours every time you went up round trip. Wow. Okay. So that must also gave you a lot of time to think about stuff.
It sure did.
Okay. So this pastor's meeting you for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You just got off the train for 2 hours. And I assume your wife is good with this, saying, "Oh, you know, I haven't seen you all day and you had a 2-hour train trip. Why don't you just have dinner with the pastor?"
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
That was one reason to be out that she was...
There you go.
...entirely in favor of.
Okay. And so what kind of stuff are you talking about with your pastor?
Well, you know, all manner of personal, financial, and religious things. You know, he was a great guy who seemed... I'm a very skeptical person, so I don't think I would have been able to have more than a 10-minute talk with somebody who I thought was only interested in me as a notch on his conversion belt.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So he really took an interest in my family and in my life, and I think he felt challenged and stimulated by talking to someone who didn't think about the world the way he did. So he had a sufficient degree of self-interest in it that I felt comfortable talking with him. One thing I remember very clearly is as I was approaching a moment when I felt like I could take a leap of faith, he said, "Well, what do you think's holding you back?" And I said, "Well, part of it is that while I walked away from God 15 years ago, I never felt the need to renounce the Catholic Church, and I'm not angry at my parents and want to reject what they did. They brought me up in the church, and I feel like I owe some respect to that."
Mm-hmm.
And he said something that was really quite remarkable. He said, "Well, you know what? These denominations, they don't really mean that much." He was from the, as I said, Christian Missionary Alliance. He said, "There's some CMA churches where they're preaching the gospel and doing good ministry, and there's some that I wouldn't let my kid walk into."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "And I'm sure the same is probably true for Catholic churches as well." He said, "I think there's as much variance within the denominations as there is between them." And that resonated with me because I had studied statistics, right? And that would be a way to think about differences between groups in a statistical sense. Mm-hmm. And a year or two later after my conversion, it occurred to me, after getting to know this pastor very well, that he didn't know anything at all about statistics. And so
So you mentioned your conversion.
Yeah.
Was this a lightning strikes moment? It doesn't seem that way. It seemed that, you know, small little steps building up the Bible study, these dinners with the pastor, you know, a few conversations by saying, hey, maybe it's time to just let go of that Catholic Church thing that you're holding on to and go into the world of Christianity in general. Is that it, or was there a moment in time that
you know, was a moment in time. All of those things were certainly one by one knocking the legs of my resistance out from under me. But there was a kind of willfulness to my attitude that required some breaking down. And let's just say my wife and I were struggling in our marriage, and I was never a kind of happy agnostic, devil may care kind of guy. My attitude was I was going to be more morally upright as a secular humanist than mm-hmm. believers could be. And mm-hmm. I was going to prove to everybody that I could do so on my own. And so I was basically self-righteous, secular self-righteous.
Okay.
And did a pretty good job of making everyone around me miserable in the process. And that had a big toll on our marriage, and I drove our marriage into a brick wall, basically, with my attitude. And at a certain point, it became clear that I wasn't going to be able to fix that. And I had a moment where I said, you know what, God, I've done everything I could, and I can't do it anymore. You're going to have to do it for me. So I think there really was a particular moment where I came to depend on him rather than my own, mm-hmm. What I thought were my own considerable powers.
And that is, you know, interesting in thinking about in a sociological framework here. I mean, a lot of the little barriers are lowered, but they're still very difficult steps that you have to take. And as I mentioned at the beginning, that Indiana Jones step onto the invisible bridge, you have
right.
that moment. Yeah.
No, and I think, you know, I think the context and the sociological factors matter for the direction that it went in.
Right.
The small group, one function of it was we, you know, California in the 1960s, we moved into an area, we didn't know anyone, and before we looked, we knew it, we turned around, and everyone we knew was associated with a particular church.
Mm-hmm.
From a sociological standpoint, it's clear, you know, we're tumbling towards conversion at that point, but I think that there was some individual spiritual work that had to get done as well.
Mm-hmm. So the next part of your life, and this for me is very fascinating, and I hadn't known a little bit about this Princeton stuff, so that was some good backstory there. But what we've talked about in the past is that when you're in New York, now, did you move up to New York?
Yes, we moved to New York after 3 years in Princeton. The commute had just gotten to the point where I couldn't, it was wearing me out. Trying to get tenure. Trying to do that commute, trying to be involved in my church community by this stage, I was just wearing myself thin. And when the opportunity came for us to live in some NYU housing, we jumped at it.
Okay, so you move up to NYU, and what's critical about this time, for at least our conversations that we've had in the past, is that you get involved in something known as Mosaic,
mm-hmm.
and that is really kind of cool, and I can hear from what you've been telling me up to this point where a lot of this stuff is going, but give us an indication of what Mosaic is, what you did, and how you're doing all this stuff in New York.
Okay. Well, we moved up to New York, and we got involved in a small congregation in Tribeca through a mutual friend that was involved in worship ministry there, and but we didn't feel like we had really found our church home, and we met a couple who were moving from California to plant a new church that would become Mosaic Manhattan, borrowing its name and a lot of its orientation from Mosaic in Los Angeles, which is a church started by Irwin and Alex McManus, which was devoted to... I guess the central focus of Mosaic is the idea that God is the creator of the universe, and if spiritual formation is about being transformed into the likeness of Christ, we should become self and aware of ourselves as creative beings. So it's a church movement that's organized around the idea that people should be encouraged to be creative.
And how did you meet these people that are moving from Los Angeles? Did they just kind of bump into them in the street? They drop some groceries, you help them pick them up, or what?
Well, yeah, it was very interesting. It was the summer after 9/11. We moved to Lower Manhattan on August 11th, 2001. Mm. How's that for timing?
Yeah.
And the summer after 9/11, a colleague of mine had a friend at UC San Diego who wanted to be in New York for the summer. And the opportunity came up that we would swap our apartment for their house in San Diego. And after 9/11, everything that happened that year, we felt getting a summer outside the city might not be such a bad idea. So we decided to do that. And my wife and I, independently, the minute we decided to go to Southern California, logged on to see what was happening at Rick Warren's church, Saddleback, that summer. And on the front page of the homepage that day was a story about a couple leaving Saddleback to go to New York to start Mosaic Manhattan. And it turned out that I recognized this young pastor and his children because they had attended the church service at the church that I was leading worship at the day before.
Mm. So I got to stop and ask here, because again, this is, you got to ask the question, is this providence or is this just...
There's a lot, you talked about Presbyterians before, there's a lot to my story.
Yeah.
That seems to have that hand in it.
Yeah, it seems that way. And then also from a social scientific perspective, we say, well, we embed ourselves in these communities and the networks can be dense at certain points in time. So this node has a higher probability of connecting to that node at any given point in time.
Right.
But there does seem to be a little bit more going on than that.
One might think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we immediately contacted this couple, met with them a couple times, and two other couples, well, one other couple and a young pastor from, Dustin's going to kill me, I think Illinois, and we're excited about their vision of what they wanted to do. We went out to San Diego for the summer, and then when we returned in the fall, we were part of a small group of people who started holding early services of this church.
Okay, so you gave us a little bit of flavor for the theology of this Mosaic church. Mm-hmm. Give us a little flavor of the organizational aspects of it, because it is somewhat unique, I think, relative to other things you've experienced, although it might have some, the small group aspect of it is very important. So tell us about the organization of Mosaic and actually about how you go around building this. I mean, do you do it in an apartment complex? Or are you doing it in a warehouse? What's happening?
Yeah, well, our first meetings were in Greg's apartment in Battery Park City in Lower Manhattan. But we held what we call preview services at a movie theater that fall. Did we do it in a movie theater? Now, first we were doing it in a hotel ballroom in Battery Park City.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the church really got founded when we started meeting at a local elementary school.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Is it a public elementary school?
It's a public elementary school, not without some controversy.
Yeah.
They originally told us they weren't allowed to hold church services there, and we had friends who knew the law well enough to say, no, actually the law says that if you're renting to some value-based groups, you have to rent to all.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been, I think, they had Boy Scout meetings there or something like that.
Okay.
So they rented to us and turned out to be very happy. I think we were good tenants and had a reasonably good relationship with the community there.
And so did you do the regular Sunday church service thing? Was there additional to it? What was the same about it with your traditional churches, and what was different?
Well, it was, I mean, it's in some ways it wasn't all that radical in the sense that there's these kinds of small church plants happening in various places all around the country. We had bought into, to a certain extent, the kind of Willow Creek attractional model, have a great worship leader and lots of great PowerPoint, and really important to brew the best coffee in town.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Very careful about the quality of our bagels and things like that. So it was really not far off of what's become now the kind of standard attractional model. We had money from traditional denominations, some traditional denominations, and some other churches in town that were willing to support us, and we were relatively eager to spend that money to kind of put on a quote-unquote good show.
Yeah. No, I know at one of the churches I previously attended, Mosaic took Mosaic down in Los Angeles had taken a show on the road, and we had a 1 or 2 day extravaganza, and it's pretty cool. It's almost like Cirque du Soleil in some respects. So
yes, they were they. I mean, I don't think we ever fully reproduced the kind of multidisciplinary artistic vision that Irwin's crowd has done very, very well. We had some, there were a lot of people in New York that had been sent by Mosaic in a very informal way as missionaries. I think one thing Irwin did very well was convince people to go out there and pursue a dream about what God could do with them in the world, and that led a lot of people to come and work at Starbucks in New York and pursue their crafts and their arts. And so we were able to lean on some of that community to incorporate dance and visual arts and things like that into.
Were you in the band?
I was in the band.
I would have to expect that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was very high pressure. You know, we really felt like we wanted people to walk into the church and not be able to distinguish what they'd hear at a high quality club in New York.
So okay.
We put a lot of time and energy into getting things just right.
And how did you grow? Was this a slow slog, or all of a sudden, whoa, the best show in town is over here at this ballroom, and now it's over at the elementary school? You folks got to be there.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It wasn't. It turns out we weren't the only people with this idea, and there were a lot of other churches, a lot of people coming from all over the country to plant churches in New York, and they would have snazzy promotional videos about what they were up to, and they always focused on the fact that New York was 25 million people living in an unchurched area. And having grown up in the New York metropolitan area, I thought that was a really curious turn of phrase.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because in the past month or two, we've had two shows with Tony Carnes, who runs, best you can call, an internet journalist research project called A Journey Through New York City Religions, and we'll link to those podcasts. And he has a very interesting take. He's literally walking the streets of New York City looking for anything that looks or smacks a little bit of religiosity, spiritualism, and investigating it. And his take on it is that New York is just busting at the seams with spirituality. What's your view here in the first decade of the 21st century?
I think that's right. I think if you read, again, to mention Stark and Finke, The Church End of America, in the middle 19th century, rather, when the upstart sects were growing in leaps and bounds, the pastors, the ministers and leaders of traditional mainline denominations were bemoaning the fact that no one ever went to church anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So the one constant in religious life is for people to sort of define what they do as religion, and then to completely be blind to any other religious practice that isn't happening in their pews. And so my experience with New York, and it continues here in Ann Arbor, where there's a constant sea of people coming to save the people of Ann Arbor from the wicked liberals at the university, there's a constant sense that area, there should be lots and lots of low-hanging fruit. And then people come into the area, and it's not like they imagined. There's not fish jumping into the boat every Sunday morning. And so the irrational exuberance that led them to do ministry in this area, thinking that the fields were ripe, suddenly descends into, oh my gosh, no one else has been successful here. Why did I think I could? So people, I see people involved in ministry vacillating between this irrational exuberance and complete despondency.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, I think the truth is a lot more in the middle.
Yeah.
I think these are heavily churched areas. They just happen to be engaged in practices that aren't what people in another part of the country do on Sunday morning, so they don't recognize that there's church.
Yeah, I hear you completely there, and this again is what Tony Carnes is finding. He's finding people who don't go to church on Sunday, but they're on Jesus's auto body shop on Friday evening holding a Bible study.
Absolutely.
And or ministering to people at their hair salon or things like this in ways that you don't expect them. And I see this a lot on Facebook where half the people are bemoaning the fact that, you know, we're going to hell in a handbasket and religious culture and falling away from grace, all etc. And then the other half saying, oh my gosh, we're just, you know, we're at the point of the rapture and we're just bursting at seams with all this stuff. And it's just like, yeah, no, it ebbs and flows, it changes and manifests itself in a lot of different ways.
Well, and what often gets ignored, ironically, compared to the 19th century cases, there's still a fair number of people in the mainline churches and
yeah.
in the Catholic churches that evangelicals come to town and don't recognize that those people as Christians to some extent and feel like they have to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've grown to the point where I find that to be a dubious activity.
Yeah, no. Well, let's continue on with the story. So you gave us a flavor for what's going on in Mosaic, and you're in New York City, and once again, you get recruited away from the Big Apple and to Michigan. I don't know how you do that. You're going to have to teach me how to do that.
If you need any evidence of supernatural activity, like my career.
So how did you get pulled over to the University of Michigan? Because NYU is a very, very, very good school. But the University of Michigan, that's, you know, a top 10, if not top 5 department. So you move from very, very, very good to excellent. And just what's going on there? How'd you get there?
Well, I was very happy at NYU. And I thought we'd be there for the rest of my career. It's a great department and a great community. And in many ways, I really miss my colleagues at NYU. Really, it was mostly personal. I don't know what would possess Michigan to come and ask me to come out and look around, but when we did, we saw a lot of things that were attractive from a personal standpoint. We had essentially raised our two oldest kids in a youth group at our church in Princeton, and then when we moved to New York, our younger kids, after a few years, were approaching middle school and high school age, and our church there was very exciting, but the pattern in New York, and you can hear Tim Keller at Redeemer Press complain about this as well. People have a tendency when their kids hit middle school and high school years to flee to the suburbs. And so the churches in New York are, even the most vibrant and growing ones, have a funny demographic that are very scarce on teenagers. And we were kind of nervous about kind of raising our kids, not nervous about raising our kids in the city, but raising our kids in the city without other parents that we shared faith commitments with and that we could do the whole youth group and thing like that.
Yeah.
So when we came out here to look around and consider the offer at Michigan, which, as you said, was, from a professional standpoint, a very attractive opportunity as well, we visited some churches in the area, and I just became convinced that that there were things that were being offered there that I couldn't provide for my kids in New York.
So let's pack that moving van, drive over to Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
You were looking not only at the department, but at churches,
yeah,
which is very interesting.
More important.
And, okay, which is a interesting factor. Yeah. Did the folks at the Department of Political Science there know that? Say, oh, you know, we're not going to take you around to the best restaurants. We're going to drive you around to all the churches.
Actually, I have a colleague who was a Mormon who knew of my faith commitments, and he very kindly provided a list with an annotated list of churches in the area that I may be interested in checking out when we came out to look at housing.
That
was nice.
That is very cool. I don't know if that would happen here at Washington, but that is quite interesting. And I want to come back to the topic of faith and academia here at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
But I want to. So you find a church, and this is the conversation we had a few weeks ago over beer in Ann Arbor, because it's a very interesting story. You went from the Mosaic experience, building that church up, to then going to Ann Arbor, and you inserted yourself into a church that was pre-existing there. So what happens there, and where are you now?
Well, we inserted ourselves into one of the reasons we left New York was to have our kids attend what it turned out to be one of the years we were there, it was named the 13th fastest growing church in the country. And again, I got involved in worship ministry. We had 20,000 people a weekend coming to the church, and it was all very exciting. It was about as glamorous an experience can happen in that kind of attractional Willow Creek model. And great things happened there, and it was very exciting. There's nothing like playing in the band and on a Sunday when 120 people are getting baptized. You know, that's a pretty, it's a pretty powerful experience. But as time went by, Lori and I really felt as if we wanted to spend more time in Ann Arbor, and we wanted to spend time with our colleagues. And I had a graduate student who really talked to me a lot about his church experience, and through talking to him and debating, I came to see, in my opinion, the attractional model as a bit of a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed as if these churches were getting very good at bringing people in, but didn't have a very clear idea of what to do with them once they converted, and I got heavily involved in the literature and spiritual formation, and involved in some small groups loosely connected to that church, and some of my own efforts around the university community, and felt like I wanted to devote my life to community on a much smaller scale.
So this was the hammer that dropped over beer, and which surprised me, is that you no longer have to get up early on Sundays to get dressed in your finest and, you know, maybe pick up your guitar or saxophone and start playing in the band. You're working on an almost entirely small group Bible study model here.
Yeah, that's right. One thing at the church in Princeton that I was unfamiliar with in my Catholic background, but really resonated with me, was this notion of the priesthood of all believers.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor at the church was, you know, taught us that the role of ministers is not to do ministry, but to equip the saints to do ministry. And, I felt empowered to do ministry in that sense of the word, that there wasn't a clear division of labor between the laity and the clergy. And so from that moment on, through the Mosaic experience, and up to my involvement in this megachurch, I felt ordained to do ministry, and so that's what we're doing. And I guess you could say, in the church that I'm involved in now, we understand the biblical commandment to not to cease meeting with each other, but we don't see anything magical about Sunday mornings.
And how does that affect how you bring people in? Because when you talk to most people, they say, oh, you know, we want to get you involved in church. That means Sunday morning, right? And that's, you know, for us, you know, formal modeler, game theorists, that's a coordinating point, right? Is it difficult to, you know, to attract people? Maybe you're not looking to convert 1,000 people. Maybe it's just a small handful. So give me a little bit of the logic behind what you're doing here.
Yeah, I guess, here's where I'll probably be dismissed as a heretic. The phrase convert doesn't have the same resonance that it once had. I'm interested in having genuine community with people. And one of the elements of genuine community is to, through connection, through confession, if you will, what genuine community does is it helps people, wherever they are in their spiritual journey, grow, become spiritually formed. And I think that that's a process that was occurring in me for years when I wasn't attending church. And if I can be an agent in that for people who aren't attending church, then I consider that a blessing.
It seems to be a real full circle for you from where you were in Princeton to where you are now, you know, maybe looking at it from a different angle.
I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that was important to me was when I was, well, we left out the part when I was here at Michigan, I was also working at the church in New York and commuting back and forth. And at one point I took part in a study group at Willow Creek. We would go out there periodically and talk about what they were calling at the time proximity-based ministry. And at that time at Willow Creek, they said, look, we're no longer thinking of our small groups as a way of encouraging and funneling people to come to our Sunday services. We're thinking of our small groups as the goal. So if we can go into neighborhoods and communities and start a quilting bee or a baseball team or something like that and build genuine community where people are free to live their lives together and be Christ for each other, we're not really concerned that they come and show up and put money in the collection basket. And that was kind of eye-opening for me. I got to the point where I realized that I was using small groups as a means when I think really it's the end.
Mm-hmm.
And, the Christian tradition has a word for what happens when you use the means, when you confuse the means for the end, and it's called idolatry.
Yeah. That's...
And so that's sort of where we're at.
And in many ways, too, that is that you think about confusing the means with the ends and idolatry. It does... I speak to some of the sociology of religion about how religions change. And what we were talking about before is that religion is constantly changing, is that churches that start off as very spiritual, great awakening type movements eventually become very bureaucratized, and that bureaucracy becomes the thing that people start to worship. And
that's exactly right.
And people break away again, which leads me to this question. This was an interesting discussion we had over beer, which was this issue of the changing religious landscape here in America nowadays. There's this big brouhaha over nuns, people who answer their telephone. There's a surveyor on the other side. They say, what denomination do you belong to? And they say, none. And people are reading this in so many different ways. They say, oh, America finally has caught up with Europe and it's secularized. And pastors are going, oh, it's the end of the world. We've never seen so much irreligion in the world as just now. Oh, what's given where you're at? And if I called you up on the phone now and asked you, hey, what denomination you belong to, how would you answer that?
I would say none.
Yeah.
Even the word Christian sometimes is hard to get out of my mouth. If you look at my Facebook info, it'll call me a Christ follower.
Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing a lot more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes I like to say mere Christian,
mm-hmm.
to cite C.S. Lewis, or Christian without adjective.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that when you're just talking about it now, most people wouldn't say that a political independent is someone who's apolitical.
Right.
So why is someone who, without a denominational commitment, irreligious?
Yeah.
That strikes me as odd.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of hay to be made in terms of mobilizing people and mobilizing resources to combat that kind of thing.
That's exactly right. But again, that's, I think, here's where I think social science could really help ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Is if we were really careful about our survey work and got a really accurate read on religious practices, I think it would make for more effective ministry. there's a motivated bias. Church planters want to be told that no one goes to church, because then they can raise money to go out into the world and bring church to people. So I understand the motivated bias. I would say Barna is a good example of that, of people who seem to systematically underestimate religious activity. And there's an audience in the profession of the church that is receptive to that underestimate and can use that underestimate. I'm not saying anybody's willfully messing with the facts, but psychologists would call this a motivated bias. There's not an incentive for people to correct these errors, at least in their own mind. But my experience is when they get those facts wrong, when they say that 30% of the people in their community go to church, when the number is really much closer to 65%, they engage in misallocations. Mm-hmm. And that's not good. It took me a long time to figure out we serve the God of truth, and anything that's not accurate from a scientific standpoint is not going to help further the kingdom.
Yeah. No, that's I think a really good message that is getting lost among, you know, many social scientists, although we've had that bias for a long time, but also, you know, the ministry. And I would have to say that bias has been around for a long, long time, because at any time people, you know, talk to me and they say, oh, this is the most irreligious time, look at this survey, it has all these nuns, I could just write those words back in the 1970s, the 1920s, the 1880s, et cetera, et cetera.
Socrates was put to death for corrupting the youth. This is a really old idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it is absolutely. And speaking of youth, I want to finish off with one last question here that deals with your role in academia. And this was something that struck me in an earlier conversation we had a couple years ago. And it was an issue I was wrestling with at the time, and I probably still am, is the role of your religious faith in academia. Now, you've come at it from a lot of different angles here, that you've been the secular humanist at Georgia Tech and Rutgers. You've, you know, been in small groups at Princeton. You were a church founder at NYU and connected to an established church in Ann Arbor and back to small groups again. So you've been all over the map here. And both you and I are working at major secular institutions, and we got this whole church-state separation baggage that comes along with us. And so it's always, and I've gone through this with my pastor as well, and I say, you know, how do I, as a Christian, minister in the secular university? Because there, you know, that you say the wrong thing, there's going to be protests outside your door, and you, next thing you're up before a panel, and you get yourself booted. I remember you saying at one point in time you gave somebody Rick Warren's Purpose-Driven Life.
Yes.
Well, what's your take on all of this? Because when you said that to me, I was like, my jaw just dropped, and I said, you know, boy, I would love to do that too, and I have a list of 20 students, but I never did. So
my take on it is to be, and this is probably the only way in my life that I'm very conservative, to be very conservative in managing my capital as a Christian, in the sense that I don't parade around campus as a Christian professor looking to give the Christian perspective on XYZ any chance that I get, because I feel like that if I did that, then I would be stereotyped and I'd be marked as a particular thing, and everything I said from that point on would be discounted accordingly.
Yeah.
It's not that I hide my light under a bushel, but I try to separate, in some ways, my two lives, in the sense that I never want to use my status as a professor to try to endorse or leverage my personal religious commitments. Right?
Yeah.
It's my status as a professor is something that the people, the taxpayers in the state of Michigan pay for. They don't do that to subsidize my religious views. That said, I don't stop being a Christian when I walk onto campus or into a lecture hall or anywhere else. So I try to be salt and light. I'm not often successful because I'm righteous jerk that can put his foot in his mouth sometimes, but...
But a darn good jazz musician.
Thanks. So, now, the story you referred to about giving a student Rick Warren's book, this was somebody who I'd been working with closely for 2 or 3 years, and who was in my office talking about her personal life, in particular relationship problems, and, you know, it wasn't, in my mind, a professional discussion. Mm-hmm. And I explicitly stepped out of my role as professor and said, well, to the extent that this impacts your career, this is the advice I can give you. But if you're talking about your life, and if you give me permission to talk about your life in a more holistic way, I'm going to talk to you as a person, not as a professor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you definitely, you know, stepped outside of that role and, you know, said, here's where I'm coming from.
And it's not something that I do with any regularity. I do,
You're not out there in white robes with, you know, the Psalms and the New Testament passing out those tracts and such.
No, because my own introspection tells me that what matters is relationship. And I don't feel like I have earned the right to speak into someone's life on religious matters until they've invited me into their life in a personal relationship.
And I think that really is indicative of where you've come through your spiritual journey and your academic journey as well. So a lot of understanding that you have today is really brought from your past experiences.
Yeah, and, you know, I also want to emphasize, I'm not without my own doubts and changes as well. You know, I don't really think of myself as someone who has it all together. I don't think that if you read the book of Acts, it's not necessary that somebody be spiritually finished for them to be actively used by God. So I'm just one person trying to figure it out just like everybody else.
Well, we leave it with that unfinished journey that will continue on, and it has been a joy speaking with you once again, this time for the World Wide Web to hear us, but I'm sure many other times we'll be grabbing a beer and talking some more. So, Bill Clark, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure, and look forward to that real soon, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.